This is Bill Plotkin on May 2nd, 2008. His talk is entitled Nature and the Human Soul, Ecocentric Individuation in an Egocentric World. This lecture was accompanied by a one-page diagram of the 8 stages of human development, which you can find on the web if you search for the word soul-centric. And the video of this talk is available in the C.G. Jung Society of Seattle Library.
To introduce Bill Plotkin, by noting a kind of synchronicity that's happening in Seattle, we had the Dalai Lama here talking about the seeds of compassion. We had Joanna Macy here. For those of you who don't know her work, she's the one who speaks of this time of the great turning that we're currently involved in, where we're all involved historically in this momentous movement from an industrial growth society that's completely unsustainable to a notion of a sustainable earth community society. And that this generation of which we are all a part have been born into the historical moment with a particular task to do on behalf of that great turning. So Joanna Macy's been here. Michael Mead is doing a workshop, one of the great mythologists of our time. And Bill Plotkin is here. And it just feels like it's a coming together in the Northwest of a very important set of people carrying some very important ideas for our time. And those of you who share my own sense of concern and despair about the trajectory that our society is on, realizing that the worst things that are going to happen have already been happening to other people in the world and just haven't reached us yet, we need to find sources of hope. And it's particularly interesting to me that the kind of hope that Bill Plotkin offers in his two books, Soulcraft and the one he's going to talk about tonight, in my mind come directly out of Carl Jung's thought. To me, this latest book that Bill will be speaking about tonight is about the process of individuation. And in the little book review that I wrote for the Jung Society, I talk about individuation as a subversive act, that what it's subversive of is the industrial growth society. And Jung would be happy to know that Bill Plotkin has written a book that has revisioned the process of individuation across the lifespan for us. So it's been very exciting to hang out with Bill for the last few days, to see him speaking with Joanna Macy. It's a real pleasure to welcome him here to the Northwest. So welcome, Bill Plotkin.
Over the last, since this second book came out about, well, in January, late December, I've been speaking to lots and lots of groups, and what has been most exciting to me is the conversation. So I'd like it to be as much as a conversation as possible, and there's two ways to do that. After the break, we'll do question and answer kind of thing. And before then, I want to invite you to think and even more importantly, feel about what's most on your minds and in your hearts these days, whatever it is, and whether it's related to my topic or not. My topic is the entire human lifespan, so you're covered. Okay. And I'll do my best to pick that up, what you're feeling, and address that, because there's so many things to say. I'm an extreme introvert, and it's interesting speaking to groups. And usually it's hard to find two sentences to string together, but when I'm talking about my work, it's hard to keep myself under 5 or 6 hours, so I have to, you know, pick and choose among what to talk about tonight. So if you can really feel what's most important to you, that actually would help me. So as Randy already got us started on, and everybody knows it's a difficult time in the world now. It's a very, very, very dark time, And you probably also would agree with me, it's a time of enormous potential, radical change, great opportunity. Great is not a big enough word. It's perhaps the biggest opportunity that that life on Earth has ever received. And the outcome is completely up in the air, in question. How things will look by the end of this century, we don't know. So I think we all would agree that there needs to be some very significant changes in all the major institutions of human culture at this time. There need to be great changes in government, education, business or commerce, and religion, to name the four big ones, and not to mention our relationship to technology and so on. And so I agree with that. I assume we all do. There needs to be lots of big changes. However, to my understanding, my reading of things, perhaps the most important change this century that is foundational to all those other needed changes has to do with individuation. Has to do with how we grow whole, how we become fully human, or even if we do become fully human. So what I've been doing as a nature-based soul guide, I've been a psychologist, research psychologist as well, psychotherapist, and I've become a developmental psychologist, and I'm a wilderness rights guide. I've become particularly interested in the question, how are we humans designed by nature to grow? Not by culture, but by nature. So I've been researching this in a number of ways for 25 years, and this book is a result of that research. And there's about 21 different categories of influences, some of them scholarly, some of them experiential, some of them direct reading of the signs from the natural world. I'm not going to go through those 21 categories, but they're in the book. But the primary template for this map of human development is nature itself. What are the cycles and qualities, patterns, rhythms we find in the natural world, and what does that say about how we are to grow as humans? And part of the natural world is the soul. It's the human soul. It's something that we are born with or as. Collective unconscious is part of nature. It's something that springs forth from this world and that we are related to. The sacred stories we found all around the world, the sacred stories we call mythologies, are telling us something about how we are meant to grow whole as human beings. And so the mythologies, for example, as inventoried by Joseph Campbell, is a major source of this work. And so the premises in this work are that a mature society requires mature individuals. I don't know if that seems radical to you or not, but and by a mature society, I mean a life-sustaining society, a deeply imaginative, healthy society or societies, because diversity is so important in all world cultures. So that's the first premise. The second one is that nature provides us the most effective, most appropriate template for how to become mature as individuals and thereby as societies. And the third premise is that each one of us is born with a kind of destiny, and namely the destiny to live a mystical relationship with the more than human world, Each of us, as humans, we're actually born, all of us, as mystics in a sense. And our destiny is to become visionaries. I believe every human being is born to be a visionary. And that means that the biggest choices of our life, of our lives, are rooted in revelatory experience. It's not that visionary life is not actually meant for just the special, unique, unusual few. That we're all designed for that experience. And whether we get there or not has everything to do with how our culture supports our growing and how well the culture orchestrates the dance between nature and culture. Of all the species we know of on the planet, we are the species that whose development is most dependent upon culture. There are some species that the parents basically conceive the young, and that's about as much culture as the young get. And then as you move your way through the various species, through mammals, culture becomes more and more important. Well, it's mostly important for us. We have the longest period of juvenility. And so if our culture diverges too far from its origins in the natural world, culture begins to undermine our own growing, our own individuation. And I believe that has happened, and it's been a 5,000 to 10,000 year long process where we have diverged, our cultures have diverged more and more from the natural world and from the soul, which is really the human dimension of nature, in addition to our bodies. I believe that in the Western world today, that approximately 75% of Americans, at least, never grow beyond adolescence, psychological adolescence. Which means we end up with an adolescent society. And if you have a society that there's relatively few people reaching true adulthood and true elderhood, then the nature of adolescence and childhood itself begins to get twisted and deformed and pathologized. And so the term I've ended up having to use, it's not a pretty one, for contemporary society is patho-adolescent. A healthy adolescent society would actually be a great improvement. And I think we only have, who knows how long, some people say 5, 10, 15 years to really turn things around to at least a healthy adolescent society, which has which kind of qualities? You could too, list all kinds of qualities about a healthy adolescent society, but maybe the most crucial central one is simply this. A healthy adolescent society takes care of its own environment. It doesn't destroy the very matrix that births us and supports us. And our current society is, as everyone knows, destroying the very matrix of our lives. Okay. I want to start, I did this the other night, I think I'll do it again tonight because it worked pretty well. Start kind of in the middle of this model. This is an H-stage model of human development, and it's not what you would normally call empirical for the scientists here. It's not primarily based on studying the lives of college freshmen and sophomores, which so much psychological research, of course, is based on. It's not even based on taking more general survey of the lives and the way people mature through the lifespan in the Western world. Because as I already said, I don't believe the way we mature in the Western world is an adequate or inspiring template for how we're designed to mature. So what I think this model does instead, in addition to what I've already mentioned about being based on in the natural world and mythology and many other things, is that it gives us a reading how the most mature, the most healthy, approximately 25% of Westerners mature or individuate, the stages that we're meant to go through. So I want to start in the middle, right in the middle of this cycle, and you all have a handout, right? If you don't, there's somebody who knows where other handouts are, and they're about to be distributed. This handout is the basic map of the what I call the ecocentric developmental wheel. And it starts in the east and it ends in the east. It starts in the east and goes clockwise, sunwise, through the eight stages. Two of childhood, two of adolescence, two of adulthood, two of elderhood. And the middle place is in the west. And the west is a transit. Each of the eight major. Oh, we ran out? Is that what happened? We had a great turnout. Okay, so in the west is the. Each of the eight compass points are the transitions between stages, and between them are the stages. There are actually nine passages, because birth and death are both in the east. And then what you'll see in the west is what I call soul initiation, and that's the moment when we make a commitment, sacred commitment, to living into the world the unique individual mystery that we individually were born to manifest, to carry as a gift to our people, and actually not just our human people, but the more than human world. So that's a fundamental idea at the foundation here, is that we're each born to have a particular place, a unique place in this more than human world. And this unique place has nothing to do with a job. Well, it can't be defined by a job. It can't even be defined by what we would call normal social roles. The unique place is something mystical. It has to do with that mystical relationship we're each designed to have with the world. Let's see, I'm going to do a little tangent here and define some important terms. I use the same basic cosmology of the world that we find in nature-based cultures all over the world, and that is that the world can be divided into three zones, or three, sometimes just we use the word world, upper world, middle world, underworld. And becoming fully human has a lot to do with developing a relationship with all three of these worlds, upper, middle, and lower. And the middle world is essentially the everyday human village world. It's the world in which we raise children, educate children, build our houses, gather our food, create civil society, take care of business, keep warm, etc. Okay. And in the world today, most people would say that's the whole world. What else is there? Because we've lost the transpersonal to quite a degree. The upper world is has to do with, it's really a domain of consciousness. It has to do with our relationship with what we would call the divine or spirit or the great mystery, the non-dual, the transcendent, the universal consciousness of which each of us is one very tiny part, the universal. And there are spiritual disciplines for being in relationship with that greater consciousness. And so think universal when I talk about upper world. And underworld has to do with the very unique, the very individual, the underworld, the lower world. It's the place of the dark, of death. Jungians don't need to be much explanation here. It's the place of soul, death, darkness, destiny, calling. It's the place of the underworld journey, which is what Campbell was writing about, the hero's journey, not the immature Hollywood hero's journey, but but the one that we're all designed to go on, in which we are essentially our consciousness and our way of belonging to the world is disintegrated. It's the dismemberment experience, so that nature can reform us in a more mature pattern. So here's my definition of soul. For me, what I mean by soul is it's a thing's ultimate place in the world. It's actually a kind of place, not a geographical place, but a place like role, R-O-L-E, or status, or position. But it's a our ultimate place is a mystical place, and it's defined by nature, not by culture. That's why soul can't be defined by jobs. It's pre-cultural. If we're born into the world with a mystical image to live into life, it's pre-cultural and pre-linguistic, for that matter. Poet David White has another one of my favorite phrases for soul. He has a few. One is, he says, it's the largest conversation we're capable of having with the world. It's a conversation. So actually, from that point of view, and from the point of view of ultimate place, soul is not something inside of us. Soul is actually something in the world. Each individual thing's soul is in the world, and we can either be in our souls or not. If we're not in our souls, we're not living the life we were designed to live. So it's a different twist on this notion of soul. Another phrase from David White from one of his poems is, he asks the question, what shape waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky?
Would you say it again?
You bet. If it's a poetic phrase, you'll get it at least twice from me. What shape waits in the seed of you? What shape waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky? What shape waits in the seed of you? Think of acorns here. What shape waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky? Okay, so starting in the middle, that's what I said I would do. At soul initiation, we become visionaries, which are what I believe true adults are. And here's a poem. It's a David White poem called All the True Vows. And I believe this poem beautifully embodies the moment of soul initiation. The moment that the first four stages of life are aiming towards. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. All the true vows are secret vows. The ones we speak out loud are the ones we break. There's only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. Only one life you can call your own, and 1,000 others you can call by any name you want. Hold to the truth you make every day with your own body. Don't turn your face away. Hold to your own truth at the center of the image you were born with. Editorial comment. There's another great phrase for what I mean by soul. The truth at the center of the image you were born with. Hold to your own truth at the center of the image you were born with. Those who do not understand their destiny will never understand the friends they have made, nor the work they have chosen, nor the one life that waits beyond all the rest. By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the waters. quick quiz here. Which truth?
The truth at the center of your own image.
Truth at the center of the image you were born with, and the one you make every day with your own body. See, I think body and soul is what we're born into the world as, in some sense. And this poet, not a depth psychologist, covers both here, the two truths. The one we make every day with our own body, the one at the center of the image what we were born with. By the lake, in the wood, I call this the wilderness right stanza of this poem. By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the waters. Whatever you hear from the waters, remember, it wants you to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Okay, there's two parts there. There's you whispering the truth that you know with your mind, and then you wait. What does nature whisper back to you? It takes it even deeper. By the lake, in the wood, in the shadows, you can whisper that truth to the quiet reflection you see in the waters. Remember, whatever you hear from the waters, it wants you to carry the sound of its truth on your lips. Remember, in this place, by the lake, in the woods, in the shadow, remember, in this place, no one can hear you. And out of the silence, you can make a promise it will kill you to break. That way you'll learn what's real and what is not real. Remember, in this place, no one can hear you. And out of the silence, you can make a promise it will kill you to break. That way you'll learn what's real and what's not. I know what I'm saying. Time almost forsook me, and I looked again. Seeing my reflection, I broke a promise and spoke for the first time after all these years in my own voice, before it was too late to turn my face again. Seeing my reflection, I broke a promise and spoke for the first time after all these years in my own voice, before it was too late to turn my face again. Did you notice there were two promises in this poem? The second one mentioned is the promise that you and I and everybody we know made when we were 2 or 3 years old, and we don't remember making it, but you know the consequences of it. And if you're like me, you're still living with it in some ways. And that promise we made when we were very young was to not speak in our own voice, not to sing our own true song, not to be our magnificent self, because it would get us in too much trouble. It was getting us in too much trouble. And we made that promise when we were 2 or 3, and we made it again when we were 5 and 9 and 13 and 16 and so on. We might have made it this morning when we got up from a difficult dream. Who knows? So the poet says, and I completely agree, at some point we have to break that promise. And we have to agree. We have to say yes to speaking in our own true voice again and living the one life we're born to live. And it's very risky to do it. And only a mature individual, mature ego, you might say, should risk it, and could risk it. The nature-based people tell us, or the old stories from the nature-based people, the indigenous people, tell us that we are, as humans, we're designed to make that, we're designed to break that promise. Let me back up a second. I want to say something about the other promise first. This will be better. Okay, so at some point we have to break that promise that we won't speak in our own voice. The other promise, the first one mentioned in this poem, is the one that will kill us to break. That's the moment of soul initiation. When we know enough about that image, that mystery, that larger story, that mythos, that bigger archetypal pattern that we have an individual relationship to, that we're meant to live into this world. We know something about what that is. never defined in cultural terms. It's defined in image, myth, nature, metaphor, that kind of thing, dream, revelatory image or vision. And it's a promise that will kill us to break, because when we make an agreement with the world that, yes, I know what I was born to live into this world and I'm going to do it, if we forsake or betray that promise, it kills us spiritually. So it's a big, big moment. Okay, so the nature-based people I was saying a while ago, my reading is that they essentially tell us that we're all designed at approximately age 13 or 14 to make that promise. And we're initiated into our adulthood at puberty. Good Jungians say 42 and a half. They're actually not that specific. We're not that specific. We say midlife. That a person is not really ready until midlife to really make the journey or the descent to soul. And I just pretended that 85 was the age most of us tend to think we'll live to, and so 42 and a half is half of that. But it's in midlife, the midlife crisis, if you will, that as Jungians we say, okay, that's when people are really ripe. And I think that's true for most people aren't ripe ever, actually. But those who are, we tend to be ripe for that journey in midlife. Indigenous people say 13. I say that contemporary people raised in a healthy society could get there at about 16 to 20, at least could begin the journey at that age. It's hard to imagine most teenagers now that would be ready for that. But I've met a few who were not only ready, but have done it. And it all depends on how our culture supports us to grow. So that's what I want to talk about now, at least an overview. The first four stages. How do we get to that point of becoming visionaries? Oh, here's an important tangent, if I haven't already said it. I believe that visionaries are what we most need in this century, because we have the task of reinventing culture and we can't do it with our strategic conscious minds. The great cultural historian who's 93 now, Thomas Berry, tells us there's no culture on the planet now whose resources can be trusted to reinvent a society that would be sustainable in the 21st century. That we have to essentially start over. And so we ask him, well, how do you start over? And he says, we need to reinvent culture in the same way we invented it back 500,000 years ago or so, and ever since. And that is he calls it the descent into the pre-rational instinctive resources. He says, what we need now is not transcendence, but incendence. He made that word up, incendence. Have to go down, not up. We need to dream, to have the visionary experiences again. And it's not like anybody's going to have the visionary experience of how all the institutions should be redone or anything like that. But each person has the vision of what their particular piece of making life is. And if there's enough people doing that, a healthy culture grows out of all those individuals. And so we need a lot of visionaries this century. Okay, so there's eight stages. There's about eight parameters of each stage. I won't go through all eight, don't worry. I just want to mention one parameter of the first four stages, and that's developmental task. In this model, what helps us grow through each stage is addressing the developmental tasks of that stage. And I didn't start out with this model 25 years ago with any preconceived notion of how many tasks there'd be in each stage, but it turned out there were two in each stage. And after about 20 years of working with it, it occurred to me, a little embarrassed it took that long, that not only were there two tasks in each stage, but one task was clearly nature-oriented and the other one was clearly culture-oriented. That was one of those, it was many confirmations like that in the design of this model where things I could not have predicted showed up and it worked. The first stage of life is early childhood, and that's from birth to the moment, that extended moment when a child becomes conscious of herself as a self. That's the psychological birth of a child, is at the end of the first stage. When autobiographical memory shows up, when I can tell you a story as a child, I can tell you a story in which I'm one of the characters in the story. Autobiographical memory. When I know really, I get the first horrifying, ecstatic understanding of what the word I means. Okay, do you remember that? Most people don't remember that moment. But age three or four for most people. And in the first stage of life, which I call the innocent in the nest, it's on your handout, the child has no task. The East is a mystical, the Eastern quadrant is a mystical quadrant that is most in relationship with light and the transcendent, and there are no tasks in that kind of mystical relationship to the world. So in the first and the last stage of life, there are no tasks. For the individual, for the child, there are tasks, but it's the parents. And the supplementary way, the grandparents' tasks. And here's a very brief summary there of what the tasks are for each stage. For the first stage, it's preserving the innocence of the child. It's the nature-oriented task. And supporting the development of an intact, healthy, culturally viable ego or personality is the culture-oriented task. I think I'm just going to say a few things here about each of the nature-oriented tasks. Preserving the innocence of the child, this is foundational for everything else that happens in our lives. And in the Western world, as each generation goes on, there's less and less support for our original innocence. Innocence sounds simple, but it's actually a complicated topic. And I'm going to make it a little bit easier and briefer tonight by simply saying it's very close to being the same thing, innocence, as our capacity for present centeredness. Simple way to think about that is a newborn infant, everybody knows, has only the present moment. No future that it's thinking about, and no past. It's right now, right here, right now. And so you can see there's a relationship between that original innocence and our capacity to be present. Well, our capacity to be present to things and people is the foundation for relationships, any kind of relationship. If I'm going to have a relationship with you, I have to be present to you, attentive, not trying to be somewhere else, on the cell phone, doing a business deal while I'm with you. But in the Western world, more and more with each generation, there's this pressure to give our children who we love a head start. You know, if they're going to do well in this dog-eat-dog world of competitive school applications and corporate job interviews, the sooner they get started, the better. Do you love your kids? Then get them started on computer skills in their second year at the latest. And if children are born wild, well, that can't be a good thing. So we need to shape them as soon as we can to fit the molds that will lead to the good job, that will lead to the good income, that will lead to a lot of stuff to buy. So the sirens go off at the very beginning of life in the Western world. the sirens that say, you must make your child into something other than what it was designed to be. We're not even convinced we're designed to be anything. There's a problem right there. So innocence is undermined. Our capacity for present-centeredness is undermined. And we get to middle childhood, which is essentially up till puberty, psychological puberty. And it's more difficult to succeed at the tasks of middle childhood because our capacity for present-centeredness has been compromised. The nature-based task, or nature-oriented task, of middle childhood, and this is a task that both the child and the parents share. Both parents and children take some responsibility, share the responsibility for these tasks of the second stage, which is the explorer in the garden. Each stage has is named for an archetype, a human archetype, which us Jungians know about, and earth archetypes, which maybe we're not so familiar with. So you'll see there's one of each kind of archetype paired to name each stage. So the explorer in the garden, we've gone from the nest to this larger space, this garden. And we've gone from an innocent to an explorer. And exploring is active, where innocent is relatively passive. And innocence is, in addition to innocence being passive, wonder. Wonder is the God-given gift of middle childhood. That there's no stage of life that's more filled with wonder than middle childhood, if we're having a healthy middle childhood. So the nature-oriented task is to learn the enchantment of the natural world. Absolutely essential in middle childhood. Because the more than human world is our home. And one way to think about the task of the second stage is to learn how our home works, learn what it is to be at home in this world. And being at home in this world is being home in nature and also in culture. And so what we're doing in the second stage is learning the givens of nature and culture. And learning the enchantment of the natural world means, to make a long story shorter, that children need as much time as possible in free play time in nature, alone or with their peers. Unsupervised, whether parents are watching from a distance or not, unstructured time in the natural world. It could be a backyard or city park, but outside. And what children need, and what we've always needed for at least a half a million years, is time just to observe the wild things, like streams, wind, flowers, birds, little animals, the stars, thunder, make things with mud, climb around on things, wonder about worms and ants and frogs, and have these incredible discoveries. And this is merely a young human being discovering their world, their more than human world. And if we don't allow that for our children, we end up as teenagers and people of adult body who are not truly we don't feel at home in this world. There's a certain sense of homelessness. And homelessness leads to a certain kind of anxiety and restlessness. And I think there's so many of the problems we see in our teens, both children and teens and older people, I think the primary diagnosis is alienated from the natural world, not at home in nature. And it's not in the DSM. Richard Louv is trying to put it in indirectly. He calls it nature deficit disorder. And Richard Louv, great book, many of you have seen it. It's called Last Child in the Woods. And since a lot of us are therapists here, I'll mention this, that you probably all know that there's this epidemic in the Western world of at least three things in childhood: obesity, depression, and attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, way up into the double digits of children, and each generation worse. If there's surely a sign of a culture in its final stages of decomposition, that's got to be it, when that's happening to our children. And there's a correlation, a lot of research you could find, correlation between those three difficulties in childhood and the absence of time, of free play time in the natural world. Even more exciting, that's not exciting, this next part's exciting, the first part's terrifying. The exciting part is that if you allow children with those with depression, obesity, attention deficit disorder, just very simple free play time in nature, their symptoms start decreasing immediately. It's not what we're taught in grad school as therapists, but hopefully that's changing. But it is changing. So if you ask your typical therapy client, what's going on, what's the problem, and they'll tell you, they'll never tell you, my problem is that I don't feel at home in the natural world. And what if a very large percentage of us contemporary people, that is a significant problem, as I believe it is. And as a wilderness-based guide and therapist and soul guide, a lot of the people, the adults who come on our programs, there's all kinds of different experiences and outcomes people have, but one of the most significant and common ones is people will say some version of the following thing at the end. They'll say, I didn't realize it, but I never felt at home in nature, and I certainly never felt a part of the natural world. And I had an experience on this program where I, in my bones, viscerally, I experienced myself as natural and as wild and as sacred as a flycatcher, a deer, cascading stream, the moon, the wind. I always knew that intellectually, but I never actually had that experience. And I didn't even know I hadn't had it until I had it. And once I had it, now that I've had it, everything is different. And I've just heard that said so many different ways, but many, many, many times. So that's a stage two developmental need. And the good news is that no matter how old we get or which stage we get to, we can always go back and address the tasks of earlier stages. And on our programs, a lot of people are addressing stage two tasks, stage three tasks, but primarily our specialty is stage four tasks, which is stage four is the prelude to soul initiation. So, in a sense, the foundation of all the rest of our human development, and specifically the foundation for wonder and our sense of belongingness in both nature and culture. The belongingness in culture is the culture-oriented task of stage two, learning cultural ways. And there's about seven dimensions of cultural ways that are so important for children to learn. In our educational system, they learn two, maybe three. For example, we don't learn cosmology, which is essential in childhood. And mythology is so essential. And there's many other things in the book. Okay, stage three begins at puberty. And stage three begins not when certain physiological things happen, but when our center of gravity shifts from nature and family. We're very family-oriented before puberty. That's our world. That's a primary home base psychologically, is a family, and the natural world if it's a healthy childhood. But in after puberty, the hub of our life, our psycho-spiritual center of gravity, got that from Joseph Campbell, that shifts to society, peer group, and sexuality, as it ought to shift. And the task of early adolescence, which doesn't mean teen years, it means something that starts at puberty and ends, or never ends, whenever. The task of early adolescence is to fashion a social self, a personality, that is both socially acceptable and authentic, socially authentic. And it's challenging. And in the contemporary world, it's really, really challenging. It's challenging for two kinds of reasons. Teenagers have a really hard time with the tasks of that stage in our societies because of two reasons. One is they have developmental deficits from the first two stages. They have trouble being present, and they have trouble with a basic sense of belonging in the world. And if you don't feel you basically belong in the world, and you have a hard time being present with other people and yourself, it's hard to become authentic. Everybody wants to be real. Everybody does, and it's hard to do it with developmental deficits from the first two stages. The second reason it's hard to become authentic, just socially authentic, is we live in a society that emphasizes conformity. All this advertisement about what we're supposed to look like and sound like and want. So the emphasis is on the cultural task in adolescence, namely socially acceptable. And authenticity goes out the window. And until we develop a persona, a social presence that's both authentic and socially successful, we're not psychically ready for the descent to soul, the descent to soul which happens in the next stage. Okay, so that's the next stage is the wanderer in the cocoon. You all know about cocoons in the insect world. It's a place a caterpillar walks into with lots of legs, and it's actually a tomb. It's a caterpillar tomb, a cocoon is. And who knows if the caterpillar knows that or not, but it is. And the caterpillar walks in and its body dissolves, and that's the end of caterpillar. But there's this caterpillar soup, and in that soup are these incredible cells called imaginal cells. All of us Jungians think we know what imaginal cells mean, but if you're also a biologist, then you know imaginal refers to the adult form of that organism, which is the imago. And the imago is the butterfly. And so the imaginal cells know how to take caterpillar soup cells and form them into a butterfly. And but I like the Jungian interpretation of the imaginal cells, and I say they're imagining flight. And they've been imagining flight since the birth of the caterpillar. And it takes a cocoon in order to fly. You know, we all want to fly spiritually. And then we read the fine print, you have to go through a cocoon in order to fly. And all the protective complexes inside of us say, never mind, until 42 and a half. We go see our analyst and get busy. So I believe we're designed to go through the same experience. All the sacred stories tell us the same thing. The mythologies say that's what we're designed to do. And so there's two tasks in the cocoon stage, and the first one's a goodbye, and the second one's a hello. And the goodbye is goodbye to my adolescent way of belonging. And it takes more than a goodbye. It takes all kinds of psychospiritual techniques to actually separate the adolescent consciousness from the adolescent way of belonging. And the mystery schools in the Western tradition and the initiation processes in the indigenous world are all, at least approximately half of the practices are for the goodbye, to separate ourselves from that old way of belonging. And so that's why often in the indigenous world, the individual is removed from the everyday social life, maybe brought way out into the wild, or maybe just brought to a special hut or longhouse where they don't, the individuals don't engage in everyday social life anymore. It's that liminal, it's a liminal time. And the cocoon is an extended liminal time of between worlds, of neither being what you were in society before and not knowing, even knowing yet, what your adult form is intended to be. So there's all these techniques for the goodbye, to leave the house, the adolescent house of belonging, which you just finished building. You just put the last finishing touches on your shtick, your adolescent thing. And then the elders show up in a healthy society and say, great job, let's go. We're out of here now. I'm reminded of that D.H. Lawrence poem called, I think it's called Song of a Man Who Came Through. And the last stanza is something like, what is that knocking at my door in the night? What is that knocking at my door in the night? It's someone who's come to do me harm. Oh, no, no. It's the three strange angels. Admit them. Admit them. What is that knocking at my door in the night? It's someone who's come to do us harm. No, no. It's the three strange angels. Admit them. Admit them. The three strange angels are elders or initiators knocking at the door saying, you're out of here. You've been asking the big questions. Let's go take a look at the big questions. And everything in us is screaming, I didn't mean to ask the big questions. I'm sorry. I'll never. Too late. So those are the goodbyes. The hello, which is the nature-oriented task of the cocoon, the hello is exploring the mysteries of nature and psyche. Exploring the great timeless, archetypal mysteries of the natural world and the human psyche, both. Both. Like Mary Oliver, you must now stride deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you can save. And that's the moment of entering the cocoon. So these practices, there's all kinds of practices that help us explore the mysteries. There's dream work practices, deep imagination, active imagination for this crowd. There's ways of conversing with other than human beings. There's, at our institute, Animas Valley Institute, we use counsel work, a process called mirroring, which is very different than interpreting. We use soul poetry, about 20 others. I never can think of them when I don't have my list in front of me. Trance rhythms, trance dancing, self-designed ceremony, what we call soul tasks in the natural world. There's many, many, many versions of that. And this is the kind of work we do at Animas Valley Institute. All our programs are, we call them soulcraft programs. It's a term I coined, but I didn't make up any of the practices. They're practices, they're the most, it's my selection of the most universal practices found cross-culturally for exploring nature and the human psyche, the mysteries thereof. And the goal of the cocoon stage is to uncover the truth at the center of the image we were born with. It's to uncover our mythos, our soul story, a gift that we were born to bring to the world. Again, it's we come to know that in images and patterns that are like dream images and patterns. They're not really of this world. They're of the underworld. And it's the ego's job to determine how to embody that, the delivery systems. And developing a delivery system is the task of stage five, the first half of adulthood. That's the task. Given your body and your age and your strengths and your weaknesses, and your culture and your century, what delivery systems, it doesn't have to be a job, it just could be a social role, is best to bring that particular mystery into the world. Okay, here's one more poem. Excuse me. This is a relatively short three-stanza poem from William Butler Yeats. It's just an enormous poem. This poem has been teaching me for 15 years at least. Still discovering things in it. It's called the Song of Wandering Angus.
Song of what?
Wandering Angus. It's not about a lost cow. You're all thinking that, so we might as well just right get to it. Angus is the Irish god of youth, beauty, and love. Not my fault they named a cow after it. Song of Wandering Angus. Yeats, like other poets we have sacred envy for, wrote this in his 20s, this poem. And one of the things that's most remarkable to me about this poem is that it tells you how he spent his entire life, very accurately. He wrote this in his 20s. Have I said that yet? He wrote this in his 20s, late 20s perhaps. And he lived into his mid-80s. There's three stanzas, and he wasn't a depth psychologist as far as I know. But these three stanzas perfectly fit the underworld journey in which there's severance, the sacred underworld time, these three stages, and the third is the return, or the embodiment, or the incorporation of what is learned in the underworld. Severance, threshold or liminal time, sacred world, the return, or the incorporation. Let's see. I'm just wondering if I should tell you anything else for those who haven't already, don't know the poem. The first two stanzas are really, the first stanza is entering the cocoon, this is my interpretation. The second stanza is what happens in the cocoon, and the third stanza is the incorporation, which in Yeats's life was the rest of his life. He received a vision that sustained him the rest of his life. And I haven't recited this one in a while, so we'll see if I can remember it. But I do have it written here, just in case. So, the Song of Wandering Angus. I went out to the Hazel. Okay, I'll tell you about Hazel. Hazel is a magical place in Irish lore, and there's a fish involved in this story, and it's a trout. And traditionally, in Irish, in Irish lore, it's a salmon, the salmon of knowledge. And I didn't know this, probably most of you know this, but I just learned recently that a trout is essentially a type of salmon. And the reason he says trout is that it rhymes, and salmon doesn't. Okay, but you can think of this, for you know about Irish myths, it's the salmon of knowledge, but it's a trout in this poem. I went out to the hazelwood because a fire was in my head. I went out to the hazelwood because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand and tied a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. I'll give you that stanza again. That's the opening of the cocoon phase. And the stuff about moths, well, moths are, you know, an interesting image here. And also, he's basically saying, among other things, it was at dawn. It was at that mystical time at dawn. I went out to the hazelwood because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread. Hooked a berry to the thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught and caught and caught a little silver trout. When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name. It was a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair who called me by my name and ran and vanished through the brightening air. Yes, he did say that phrase twice, called me by my name. And we're quite certain that it wasn't Bill or William, right? Okay. When I laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire. He's going to have breakfast. When I laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name. It had become the trout, a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. Ran and faded through the brightening air. So a something becomes a someone. It's a glimmering girl. If you don't know who the glimmering girl is, you flunk as a Jungian. There's only one chance, one choice. Okay. So there's the vision, the visionary experience. He goes fishing, he gets caught by what he catches. We go into the underworld, this heroic adolescent thing, we're going to catch something. And why do we go into the underworld? Because there's a fire in our head. Everything I thought was me is combusting. And so what do? I go to the magical place, I go to the Hazelwood, and I go fishing in the depths, in the waters. And if, with great fortune, and if I'm prepared, I catch something, fish. And I think, great breakfast. And then the fish catches me, and the tables are turned. And it becomes a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair. Some of you may know that's a historical reference to his muse, his beloved, his lover that he never got to marry. Maud Gonne, yes. So, last stanza, the return. Though I am old with wandering, he wrote this when he was 27, though I am old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone and kiss her lips and hold her hand and walk among long dappled grass and pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun. Though I am old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she, the glimmering girl, has gone and kiss her lips and hold her hand and walk among long dappled grass and pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun. So he knew that's what he was going to spend his time doing. He was going to pursue her, his muse or his anima or his soul, the rest of his life. And he did. And it wasn't about catching her, although there was that fantasy, I will kiss her lips and hold her hands and walk among long dappled grass autumn, where he met her in apple blossom time. And pluck the apples. And that's for you, those of you who know Yeats's life, you know he spent his life plucking those apples. And you know something about the symbolism of what those apples, moon and sun apples, are the other guy, Yeats.
As a male, you speak in terms of anima and feminine images. and your poetry that you recite for all, pretty much except for Mary Oliver, which you've mentioned, are male poets and their experiences.
Good point.
Can you speak to anything that the poets, the women poets, that have expressed their experiences?
Yeah, the question was about women poets. And we could even add to that the non-Western men and women poets. And there's both quite, there's a lot there on both sides. And of course, Mary Oliver's has quite a number of poems that speak to this kind of thing. But let me give you another one. I believe, this is my belief, okay, that the underworld journey has essentially the same structure for men and women, or more accurately, really, we should say, for people of either male or female bodies who are either masculine or feminine in their core. I believe the basic structure is the same, although the initiation processes might look different in different cultures. But how about Adrienne Rich? That be okay?
I don't know.
Not sure you're gonna.
I've read a lot of Adrienne Rich. Uh-huh.
Do you have a recommendation?
Yeah, but I'll talk to you about later. Sylvia Plath. I mean, I think she was on the journey. She did connect with the muse, and yet, because of the societal.
Louder, please. Could you just tune it up just a little bit louder?
Sylvia Plath. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think she was on the journey, and yet there's nothing in the culture that supports a female initiatory experience.
There's virtually nothing in the culture that supports a masculine or male.
But there's a lot more written.
Is there? Yeah. That's not surprising, is it, in the Western world?
Because of it, women are meant to hold on to the innocence a lot longer. And there's a lot more backtracking, I think, for women, especially in terms of legal development, than there is for men.
A lot of backtracking?
To cover lost bases.
Just more opportunity to cover? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I don't have any Sylvia Plath memorized, but I do have an Adrienne Rich.
Go ahead.
This is a prospective immigrants, please note. And then we'll take a break. Either you'll go through this door or you'll not go through this door. If you go through, there's always the risk of remembering your name. Either you'll go through this door or you'll not go through this door. If you go through, there's always the risk of remembering your name. Things look at you doubly, and you must look back and let them happen. Things look at you doubly, and you must look back and let them happen. If you don't go through, it's still possible to maintain your attitudes, to hold your positions, to die bravely. But much will evade you, much will blind you. At what cost? Who knows? The door itself makes no promises. It is only a door. Prospective immigrants, please note. Okay, so we got through the first half, and if you have some questions pertaining to the second half, we'll say a little bit about the second half in the second half, which we're going to take, a 10-minute break, something like that, and then come on back. Yes. Okay, so I'd like to open it to questions. Someone, maybe Randy or someone else, let us know when we run out of time. And I'd like to ask, if you don't mind, to make your questions, as opposed to personal stories, brief dissertations. I personally would like to hear your dissertations, but other people might not, so. Okay. Yeah.
Just a question for clarification. During the adolescent, early adolescent stage, talking about coming into a person's own authenticity, which I'm guessing is different than the next stage where you leave the cocoon, or you enter the cocoon. So becoming an authentic adolescent isn't the same thing as entering the cocoon.
Correct.
Okay.
I'll repeat and elaborate on the answer I just gave, which was correct. The question was, in the third stage of life, that's the thespian in the oasis, the half of the task is to become authentic socially. And the question was, I take it that that's different than what happens in the cocoon. And the answer was correct. Because what happens in the third stage, the thespian in the oasis, is a social authenticity. We haven't got the vertical dimension of life yet. It's this social field authenticity. And what we do in that third stage is we differentiate or individuate the self relative to society. Given my values, instincts, inclinations, attitudes and so forth, capacities and so on, how do I fashion a social self that is socially authentic? And then in the cocoon, the question becomes, is what's my deeper authenticity? What does my soul want me to do and be in this lifetime? That's the question in the cocoon. And then starting in stage 5, early adulthood, the soul apprentice at the wellspring. I didn't mention all the tasks of that stage, or the subtasks, the way of thinking about the task of the wellspring, stage 5. But one of the subtasks there, is to fashion a social presence with the primary criteria being what social persona, personality, is most effective as a carrier system for my soul's passions. And so in stage 5, we begin to differentiate our social presence in relationship to soul as the primary inspiration, whereas in stage 3, we're differentiating the self in relationship to society. And the soul, if we're going to be true to our souls, we often have to be in the world in a way that can undermine our social adjustment. And that's okay for someone in stage 5. It's disastrous for someone in stage 3. Okay.
How much of the child is left in the later stages, do you think?
How much of the child is left in the later stages? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by the child?
How much of the child do we lose? How much of our innocence do we lose?
I believe
how much is repressed, I should say.
Yeah. How much of our innocence is lost or repressed? My sense is that in the Western world, much of our innocence is repressed, and that all of it is reclaimable. I believe it's all reclaimable. And the way we reclaim our innocence is very different than the way our innocence would have been preserved, which is to say, not lost in the first place in early childhood. And we do have disciplines for reclaiming our innocence. And in the book, I list about a half a dozen at least. But the ones you'll know the best and that are probably most popular are first meditation disciplines. I think meditation disciplines are primarily about reclaiming innocence, which is to say the capacity for present-centeredness, mindfulness. Mindfulness and innocence, very close. And you think of meditation masters you've known or seen videos of or read about and so forth, they all have this childlike innocence. Wasn't that interesting? So meditation disciplines is one way to reclaim innocence. And another one are the therapies which emphasize the here and now, like Gestalt or focusing. And there's aspects of Jungian work, which is like active imagination, which helps us right back to what's happening right now. So we can reclaim our innocence and we can reclaim our wonder. It's never too late to have a happy childhood, to have our time in the natural world, and to readdress the aspects of cultural learning like eco-literacy that we missed in childhood, and to hear the sacred stories, and to hear the stories from the true elders, essential part of childhood. So, yep, I believe we can reclaim it totally. Yes, please. Absolutely, yeah. The archetypes are always available to all of them. The archetypes which are named, which the stages are named for, means that those archetypes are most resonant, you know, online during that stage. They kind of, you might say, to borrow a term from astrology, that the natal place of those archetypes are in those stages, but they're available in all the stages, including the sage, which is not very different from the innocent, really. They're related. They both have a tremendous capacity for being present-centered, the sage and the innocent.
Why is, maybe you said this, but I didn't hear, in stage 8, why is that a non-task, tending the universe?
Yeah, that's a good question. Stage 8 doesn't have a task, so I called it a non-task. And it's like stage 1. There are no tasks in the east quadrant, the east, those two east stages, because they're transcendent stages. They're stages that are in relationship to spirit. We begin and end life that way, with that kind of mystical consciousness or non-consciousness. The transition into stage 8, you'll notice, is called surrender, the passage. And what's being surrendered is any further desire to strive to do anything. So if you move beyond striving, no task. But there is something essential that happens in that stage, and that's the tending of the universe, which is done through being, not through doing. This model is almost mathematical, the way it was worked out. Once you get clear about what east is in the natural world and what west is in north and south, you can almost derive the fundamental nature of each stage through these basic concepts that are kind of like a matrix beneath the wheel itself. And what was I going to say about that? I think I was going to tell you a story actually about... I knew the basic concept of what stage 8 would have to be if it fit into the whole wheel. But I didn't know how to flesh it out. I didn't really know how to talk about it in a way that was in any way compelling to me. So I went to find a stage 8 elder, which is not an easy thing to find in our world. And the one I was very, very fortunate to find was Thomas Berry, and I spent a couple of days with him 2 years ago when he was 91. And probably most of you know who he is, and a great cultural historian who studied cultures all over the world, including the cultures of Asia. And I asked Thomas to explain to me what a sage really is, and he told me a series of long stories. And one was from ancient China, something like 6th century B.C. And he told me a story about the old Chinese emperors. And he said the Chinese emperors back then didn't do anything. But they did tend the universe. That phrase is from Thomas. They tended the universe. And he said it was important for them that their palaces had four sections, and they corresponded to the four seasons and the four directions. And in each season, the emperor needed to move from one section to the next, and the emperor's court had to change their clothes to the correct colors, and the music that goes with that season was played, and the emperor did some basic ceremonial things that went with that season. And what that did was kept the universe going. And if they didn't, if the emperor didn't do that, the universe would stop. And then Thomas, who's a very, very wise person and not the least bit crazy, looked at me and said, in our time, we are losing the universe. We are losing the universe. The universe is not existing as fully as it was meant to exist because we are not tending the universe correctly. And he said, I just want to remind you, Bill, that the universe is not really a physical thing. He said, just to exist physically is almost not to exist at all. The universe is this grand story. And if the story is not tended, the story is diminished. And it's the stage eight elders who tend the universe. That's pretty mystical. And if you read the final chapter of my book, you'll understand it better. Yes, please.
That reminds me of Jung's story of Mountain Lake. The elder, he goes to see in Mexico, who says that if I don't do the rituals for my tribe, the sun doesn't come up in the morning. And Jung's reply was that how envious he was of the way in which this man was so assured of his place in the universe and his place of responsibility for keeping the universe going.
Absolutely. And did everyone hear that? It reminds me of a story I put in that chapter because I was wondering after speaking with Thomas, when have I ever experienced anything like that? That I call it the eldering or the saging function in society. And it was an experience I had in my early 30s in New Mexico. No, sorry, next door, Arizona, with the Hopi people. I was very fortunate in February one year to spend an entire night in a Hopi kiva during their sacred ceremonies with two of my friends. We went, and we didn't know better, so we just walked in. And of course, we were the only white people there. And it's they have their Kachina night dances in February. It's very cold up there in the Hopi mesas. And it's at night. It's from sometime after sunset to sunrise. Long night. And the bands of Kachinas come in to the kivas. There's many kivas in the villages, and they go from one kiva to another, just bands of about 10, 12 Kachinas, which are the intercessory spirits between the gods and goddesses and the people, the Kachinas. And of course, they're being impersonated by Hopi men. And they're dressed, some of you don't know what Kachinas look like, you can Google it. So these spirits are coming into the kivas, the underground sacred ceremonial rooms, all night. And there's kind of an audience portion where the Hopi men, women and children sit. And then there's a dance floor. And the Kachinas come down the ladder through the roof and they dance. And they make their particular sounds. And there weren't any seats on the audience side left. So we just sat along the bancos, little shallow benches along the side of the, my two friends and I, along the side of the dance floor. And we expected to be kicked out, but they didn't kick us out. They were incredibly gracious. They let us sit there. And by the middle of the night, I was absolutely clear. This is after several waves of Kachina's dancing. I was absolutely clear what the kiva is, and all I had was a white man's metaphor, which was this is the engine room of the universe, and without these ceremonies, the universe stops. There was no question about it. Okay. Yeah.
What you just mentioned with Thomas Berry saying that we are losing the universe. Was one of the things I was wondering about, how we are also losing sages or don't have that many in this day's society. How do we keep going forward when there's so little people? This is my thought, that have these kinds of intentions that we're speaking of, how do we move forward without going into despair?
How do you go forward without going into despair? Well, we know what to what?
Become the sage.
Become the sage through going through your individuation process. But one of the great elders in the world now, Joanna Macy, says you must go into despair. It's not how do we do it without going to despair. She says we can't do it unless we go into despair, but not orbit around it, just go right to the core of despair, and it will change us. We're afraid of despair, of the experience of despair, just as we're afraid of the experience of grief. And we must go right into the very heart of it so that it changes us. And we come out the other side empowered, as Joanna says. And the way to get empowered to really make a difference is it's experientially essential to go through the despair. And if you don't feel despair and grief, you're not paying attention. That's a sign of a certain kind of depression if you're not feeling some despair and grief about the world these days. If depression is stuck human emotions, I mean human nature, including the most common form of depression is stuck feelings. Big feelings inside, they're not moving. Maybe you don't even know how to get them to move again. Then to heal, we have to go into those feelings, not away from them. We have to go into them. And since each one of us is a part of the web of life, and our consciousness is one with the consciousness of the of life, that at some level, every one of us is inside of us a huge mountain of grief about what's happening and has been happening for generations to our world. And there's so many people who, I believe, go to seek help from therapists who think their grief is all personal. If you think it's all personal as a therapist, you're never going to help your people heal entirely, in my opinion, because so much of our grief now is transpersonal. This, I think, is partly what Hillman was getting at in his book with the fabulous title. We've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's still getting worse. And one of the greatest therapies is to get involved in making a difference, which is hard to do if you haven't been willing to go into your despair.
So what is the difference between psychotherapy and soul work?
Did I pay you to ask that question?
It was in the blurb, but you blurred for it
tonight. Oh, great. Yeah, thanks for asking that. What's the difference between psychotherapy and soul work? Okay, first I'm going to define psychotherapy, and most of you Jungian therapists will not agree with this definition. But it's not my real definition. It's just in order to make a distinction between those two things. Okay, so, and I believe 90% plus of psychotherapy in this country does fit this definition, but 10% of it probably doesn't. Psychotherapy is that interpersonal process in which promotes ego growth. And by what I mean by ego growth is it's in partly the adjustment of the ego to the world, the social world we live in, so we can function better in our social world, jobs and relationships. Psychotherapy helps us be in a better relationship with our bodies, our emotions. It helps us enhance our intimacy. It helps us heal from our emotional wounds. Did I leave out any real important stuff that most therapy is about? Most therapy isn't transpersonal. But so I'm talking about non-transpersonal, exactly. Non-transpersonal psychotherapies, which is most of therapies. And the percentage is increasing every year because of managed care and so on. And what I mean by soulcraft or the soul initiation process or the soul discovery process or soul encounter is the descent, the descent to soul to find out, to discover something about our greatest gift to bring to this world. And the soul discovery process can be quite counter-therapeutic. It can undermine our adjustment. It can wreak total havoc with our relationships. It can often ruins marriages which might have lasted otherwise. So in that sense, it's kind of counter-therapeutic, the underworld journey. It certainly, it usually puts a big dent in our retirement savings. It burns the ladder that's up against the corporate, you know, wall, the ladder of success. So it's subversive. It's anti-American. The underworld journey. So soul work, in this sense, can be counter-therapeutic. And therapy, when you've had enough, because we never are fully healed. We never are done with our complexes and our personal wounds and so on. Once we've had enough, more therapy is counter soulcraft. Gets in the way. But who do we go to when there's not enough meaning in our life? We either go to clergy or therapists, now sometimes coaches. But then that therapist and that 90% of therapists aren't going to be able to help. And it's actually a type of soul malpractice to do more therapy in someone who's healed sufficiently and is ready to move on to something else. My apologies if I offended anybody. Okay, yeah.
I just wanted to add to that, that I think that soul work makes us unfit to continue with this civilization, whereas psychotherapy helps us adapt and function within the existing civilization, and so, which is kind of like getting right to the root of it. Like, this isn't really working, and so being fit or unfit for that civilization is kind of a dividing line.
Yep. Is your therapy that you're doing, that you're conducting, is it part of the great turning or the great unraveling? Is it supporting people to be cogs in the industrial machine? Or is it engendering visionaries, artisans of cultural transformation? I believe that all healthy adults, whether they want to or not, are artisans of cultural transformation. Because if you live in a society that's pathological, like I believe ours is, then anybody doing anything healthy is doing something subversive. Not because they're liberals or something, but because they're mature.
The second part of that, and in line with what you're saying, is that also I think that the idea of, like you were saying, like the wounds are never fully healed, our issues continue, and we really need them. Like, thank God. Like, if we lost our wounds, then we wouldn't do anything useful. And you know, all the things that you say about the wound and the gift, and you know that we know that. So we need the. So like that. It's sort of this false idea that they're ever over, that they're not utterly useful in the destruction of the world that isn't working and the birthing of the world that might.
Yeah, this is an idea I think is very familiar to Jungians. Jane Houston calls it the sacred wound. I know she's not exactly a Jungian, but it's the idea that in the individuation process of the second half of life, which ideally starts, you know, 18 or 20 or so. If we go deep enough into our most core wound, we find there a treasure which is essential to our enactment of our soul work. That in the deepest, most difficult, most horrendous wound, personal wound, is something essential that's waiting there for us. So that's part of this underworld work. I think it's pretty common for Jungians to embrace that idea that in the deepest heart of the pathology is something essential for our wholeness. And we're not even able to get there until we've ecocentric and cosmocentric?
Universe, yeah.
Yeah.
And so
but relative to the universe, is it a problem what's happening on this planet? Not to me. I'll try to answer that, but I'm not sure I've got it. Two things. One is that I believe our human circle of identity grows as we mature. So that early in life we're You know, we don't have any conscious identity at all, and then our identity is ethnocentric or sociocentric. It's that what I feel is mine if I'm in a healthy family is my family. Anything that happens to my family happens to me. In early adolescence, it becomes more ethnocentric, that the realm I identify as me, mine, is my people, my village, my nation, my ethnic group, one of those. And then in the cocoon, it becomes world-centric, which means I experience my primary belonging not in my nation or ethnicity, but in the human species. It's one human family. And then in stage five, it becomes ecocentric, that my membership, my experiential, not just intellectual, experiential membership is the entire biosphere. And it won't take time to explain it now, but stage six, it becomes a more differentiated version of that. In stage seven, it begins to become cosmocentric, begins. And the cosmocentric is completed in stage eight, where how I experience myself is as the universe, that anything that happens in the universe happens to me. And the second part is a possible cosmocentric perspective is something like this. There are billions of planets in the universe that support not only life, but life that includes species with conscious self-awareness, like us. And every such planet in its development has to go through the crisis of a species early in its development that has conscious self-awareness, and that species will either destroy the biosphere of its planet or it won't. And it's a crisis, and you never can tell how it's going to turn out. And we don't know how it's going to turn out on our planet. And it's like the universe does these experiments, and not everyone works out. Some stars go supernova, and all kinds of worlds are immediately destroyed. And our planet might make it, and it might not. And we're pretty much, it's going to come down to this century. And from the cosmocentric perspective, it's okay if we don't make it. From the ecocentric perspective, it makes all the difference in the world. And something that goes along with that perspective for me is I am convinced, and I could do another hour-long lecture, which we're not going to do tonight, on my view that's been nourished by all kinds of other people's views about how we got into this mess. And I'm quite sure it's unavoidable on any planet with a species with self-conscious awareness. And in a certain sense, this tells me we didn't screw up. This was unavoidable. And if we don't make it, it's such a difficult passage that you can't exactly blame us if we didn't make it. But in a smaller, sense of like we think of our families and loved ones and our incredibly precious planet, it makes all the difference. I mean, nothing could be more sacred that we really make it this time. But it helps me to realize we actually didn't screw up. Because I'm one of those people who has been enraged at Western civilization. I'm still not particularly fond of it. Certain aspects of Western civilization are just phenomenal. The arts, medicines in some way, technology in some way, and so on. But the cultures that are based on both slavery and dishonoring of the earth, of the planet itself, that's a problem. But it helps me to realize, this was an inevitable. If it wasn't Western civilization, it would have been something else. That because it's the sacred wound of the species. Our conscious self-awareness makes us vulnerable to certain kinds of pathologies. And but without the conscious self-awareness, we're not even human. And the pathology, the primary pathology, has to do with greed, which makes us want to hoard. But greed is a pathology only certain adolescents, and usually masculine male adolescents, are prone to. But it's going to happen in every planet that has our kind of consciousness, a species that does. And so I see this time on our planet as more as an incredible test, initiation rite, rite of passage, opportunity. And it's, we can forget about having screwed up. We didn't really. It's really about the opportunity. So that was more of a riff on that question than maybe you had in mind. But
no, perfect.
Okay, thanks.
So thank you.
5 minutes? Okay. Is it developmentally appropriate that the planet, because of us humans, are at this crisis?
It's inevitable.
Yeah.
It is the process of coming to consciousness that we have fallen into certain pathological patterns.
Yeah, so if it's inevitable, is it, would you call it developmental, it's a part of the developmental unfolding? Or? Well, I'd want to use a different word than developmental. I'd want to say evolutionary. Because the evolutionary sequence is really a very different thing than an individual development of an individual, a species development is a very different kind of thing than an individual development, and so in an evolutionary sense, it's inevitable, I think. And there's some very brilliant cultural historians who have some great explanations for why. I'll mention Andrew Schmuckler. Great last name, Schmuckler, who wrote a book called The Parable of the Tribes. Check it out, the Parable. The Parable of the Tribes, or Dan Quinn's novels, you know, Ishmael, and there's a lot of them, though. Ishmael? Schmuckler, S-C-H-M-O-O-K-L-E-R. So probably one last question, yeah.
Curious why you think that we're at this point, because you could look back in time, like I can remember myself when, you know, going to school and we're learning about, you know, the possibility that we're going to be moved and stuff like that, and you go back and there's world wars, and there's plenty of times in history where it would be easy for somebody to say that the world is at a crisis. Why do you think that we're at a special crisis now as opposed to those other ones?
Yeah, what's so special about this crisis time is the question. It's the perfect storm idea. You know, peak oil that our society is, based on, our agriculture, our technology, communication, transportation, everything. The increase in the economic storm that's on its way. The fact that the poisoning of our air and land and waters, global climate change. It looks like the whole thing is coming down. But see, there's two perspectives on this. Most people in the first world, like us, our perspective is not good, looking bad, could be bad. We better make some changes fast, else it will be bad. And then the rest of the world, this has a very different perspective right now. It's the environmental, economic, etc. collapse is already happening. It's been happening for a few decades at least. And to most of the world, the question isn't will the system collapse, but no, it has been collapsing. It's already happening. And there might be some question, when will the first world wake up about it or not? And will the first world wake up before it's too late for all the species that haven't been eradicated yet? And because right in the last 100 years or so, we've had as much species lost as we had 65 million years ago. When, what was it, 99% of all species were wiped out? Oh, so it couldn't be quite that bad. Maybe it wasn't 99%, but the mass extinction that we're going through, that we're already in the midst of now, is somewhere, it's almost as bad as what happened 65 million years ago. So that's why people say, and there's other reasons some people say too, we're obviously coming to the end of a certain way of being in the world. So let's see if I can end on a hopeful note. For those of you who've seen Paul Hawkins' new book, Blessed Unrest, that's just one of many books like this. These are visionaries, social visionaries, who have been inventorying and documenting the rise of visionary individuals and organizations around the world. And there's literally millions and millions and millions of organizations all around the world who have, for quite some time now, although the whole thing's accelerating, for quite some time been in creating the infrastructure for an entirely new way of being human. And you don't find it in the mainstream press, and you'll find a lot of it in the alternative press, like indymedia.org. Indymedia.org will give you access to a lot of the independent alternative media. You know, magazines like Yes, which are published right here in the Seattle area, or Ode. There's a lot. And if you want to be inspired, stop listening to and reading the mainstream press and check out the alternative press. And it's incredible what people are doing around the world in every domain and field of the human endeavor. And meanwhile, mainstream Western society is going on as if it's going to go on forever, but you know, all the signs are it's crumbling. So I am very inspired and draw a lot of hope, not only from my own soul, but from the inspired actions of visionaries around the world. So I like to say it's, you know, the worst of time, best of times. You couldn't pick a more exciting time to have been born. Congratulations. And thank you very much for your attention tonight.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.